Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 184, being recorded on the 21st of June, 2017, with special guest, Martin Howell. I'm Sujit, and on Skype with me, I have Evan and our special guest, Martin. And Evan, it sounds like Kale is once again globetrotting, so we haven't had a chance.
Taking over the world with blockchain, right?
I know. And as a matter of fact, as you said, we did have a blockchain update for today, but we're going to, as you said, punt it for next week so he can talk about it, give him a chance to show off a little bit.
Yeah, it's not very often we get to talk about the World Food Bank and blockchain in the same thing. So, yeah, so that's a little teaser for everybody for next week.
But what do you like in this week's rundown that we have besides blockchain?
So I want to talk about the Azure Automation announcement. So I actually, one of my good friends is the technical lead for the Azure Automation support team. And I'm not kidding. Maybe a month or two ago, he was bellyaching to me about the fact that when you upload your Azure Automation jobs, the job will continue to use the PowerShell commandlets that you set it up for when you configured it. So if if there's a commandlet upgrade or whatever, you have to manually upgrade these commandlets. So what we've announced, I think starting in July, what you'll start seeing is the new runbooks will always use the latest versions of the modules that are in your account, right? So you can basically kind of get it. You can guarantee you're always kind of running the latest at that point.
Got it. Yeah, I'm surprised that I would have thought people would have hit this earlier. Or I guess they have, and they finally made enough noise that Microsoft made the change. But
yeah, we still don't do like an auto upgrade. Like we're not going to upgrade just because we release new commandlets. But when you go and upgrade the modules that you have configured for your automation account, all your jobs will now use the latest version versus kind of getting this mishmash of, the job I created 3 months ago uses version 1, the one I created last week uses version 1.2, right? You get out of that confusion
right
at that point.
Right. Oh, that's a good one. Well, I have one on the Azure Traffic Manager, and they had a couple of updates to this. I think these are good updates for customers who want to, to be able to fail over quickly when a node goes down, because that's really what Traffic Manager is all about, right?
Yep.
And typically, you have to wait 30 seconds, right, before it detects a failure and switches over. And now you have the option of selecting a shorter interval, of 10 seconds, just to make it.
And there's like a small price bump for that, or maybe like a something per month.
Yeah, it's like $1 or $2 extra per month. Okay.
$2 a month. I'm sure that's gonna break somebody's budget somewhere.
That's right. But so that was a good one. And you can also, the number of failures that can be tolerated now, you can kind of adjust that, as well as the timeout interval between each of the subsequent probes, so that those can be adjusted. So and the TTL also can be wired down all the way to zero, which is nice.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So you really can do fast at that point. The TCP probing was cool as well, because I know the problem has been for Traffic Manager historically, you have to be hitting a resource that returns an HTTP 200, right? Which lots and lots of applications don't do that or don't do that easily. So now you can just do, as long as you get some sort of TCP response, it'll consider the site to be up as well. I thought that was a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah, actually we've actually seen that recently with our customers, same thing where they have cloud services and they wait, their cloud services expects a 200 and they were returning a 302, which is a redirect.
Yeah.
It's not bad,
but
it's not a 200.
Yep. So. Yeah, exactly. It's a valid response, just not what we were looking for.
Yeah. And then this is, I thought that was a good update about the managed disks, right now supporting encryption at rest. You recall we had Amit Bapat and Dave McPherson on the show a few weeks ago, and they talked about encryption at rest. And I think, we obviously couldn't announce it at the time that this was coming, but this is here now here, and managed disks will, you know, support
Yeah,
it.
I
So,
think I want to say after the show they mentioned it was coming real soon, but it wasn't public yet.
right. Yep.
But yeah, no, it's great to see it out and released for everybody.
And
Mater disks are the way to go.
Yeah, and well, even more important, the encryption at rest feature, right? We're expecting that to get more and more prevalent in all
Yeah.
the Azure services. Currently,
Absolutely.
it's there in a few of them, but I think I've heard that it is coming to many Azure services because a lot of customers, my customer included, a financial customer, you know, they want encryption at rest. They don't want their data sitting out in Azure unencrypted.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so I think that's it. That was a quick roundup of all the updates. And let's move on to our special guest, Martin. Martin, would you like to introduce yourself for our listeners? And then we'll tell us what you're passionate about in the Azure space, and we'll take it from there.
Great. Thanks so much, gentlemen. So my name is Martin, and I hail from Birmingham, Alabama. I work for a small SMB out of, we're based out of Denver. Everybody in the company is a telecommuter, so I have the luxury from working from home day in and day out. I've been with EOS for about 15 years, and we have, we've been going through the process of migrating our on-premise hardware stack, everything we've had on-premise, which is tucked away in a data center out in Scottsdale, Arizona, and moving that all over into Azure. It's been a nice, fairly long 18-month process, a lot going on to make that happen, and came across a support case recently where Evan was kind enough to help me through it, and I've had a few cases along the way that have helped us get through the stages, get through the different hurdles that we've come across. So a little bit about what we're doing and where we're going.
Yeah, this was, you know, when I was working with Martin on this case, you know, we won't talk about what was broken. This is all happy conversation.
That's right.
we've talked over the years about, you know, the potential for people really to, you know, all they really need on premises is the client machines. Right. And, you know, I don't remember exactly how it came up, Martin, but you basically had mentioned to me like, hey, we're getting really close to moving everything out and just decommissioning the entire, you know, data center. And, you know, I wanted to kind of get you on and have you talk about kind of, you
sure.
know, where you started and what made you think this was even going to be feasible. I mean, 18 months ago, we didn't have all the functionality we have today. So you guys kind of took
right.
a leap of faith to
Definitely.
Some extent as well.
We definitely took a leap of faith. The Azure Active Directory becoming GA and seeing that coming was the key.
You're talking the domain services piece.
Domain services side
okay.
of it, that's correct. Being able to spin up VMs, authenticate, and not have to have a bunch of VMs running up there in availability sets, redundancy and everything else, replication, and not having to stand back up domain services ourselves was a key for us. That meant we could focus on what works for us, which is spinning up and shutting down VMs, doing our job to develop technology and develop software. For my purposes, I can get out of the hardware, network, data center, outage notification type of life. And as I mentioned to you on the phone, Evan, become, you know, kind of towards a billing manager, kind of towards what cost is where and who's using what services and are those machines automatically shutting down when they're not needed. The phrase internally we use is, you know, turn off the lights. If you don't need it, shut it down. So
you know,
that's kind of the direction we begin.
Martin, I'd like to just step back a little bit and ask, you know, at a high level, can you explain your workload that you have inside of the company? You mentioned a lot of IaaS. Right. So a lot of VMs essentially that you have. So is it fair to say that you were just looking to do a lift and shift in this particular scenario? How did you kind of, you know, come up with the, like when you were envisioning what the architecture would be in Azure, what was going through your minds at the time?
Sure. So to take it even a little bit further back, so the company I work for, we're both a professional services company where we implement and deploy technology and solutions, but we also develop technology and solutions. We're a Microsoft partner, so we have the opportunity to build technology and then move that technology into our client's workspace. So much of our architecture internally is to support that function. So if you go back to think about everybody who's working from home, our developers were checking in and out code on our TFS server. Our professional services team were utilizing virtual machines to model and spin up clients' or prospects' data and then demonstrate and show that to them. We were we had an environment that allowed our prospects to kind of try before you buy type technology, where they could connect to and log into a VM and see what they would potentially would see. We have some web apps, so those are running on-premise as well, and what that might look like for some of our prospects or for the purposes of demonstration. So if you think about that infrastructure and that technology and all the stuff that goes behind it, everything from build artifacts that are being checked in and out to the web services to just an FTP service to be able to store some data there. We had an on-premise SharePoint site that was used for some of our tracking internally. So each one of those pieces and parts had to be planned out. We had to figure out what we wanted to bring with us, what we wanted to just leave behind or get rid of, and then are we going to stand up new, or are we going to get rid of and just not bring over that technology or that solution, the VM? And some of them, we didn't have a choice. Some of them were, we've got to take this VM with us because it is a part of an old build process or build site, you know, an old system that needs to be maintained, and the effort it would take to spin up a new VM would be greater than just a migration of that VM.
Yeah. Sorry, you meant you didn't want to reinvent the application in a cloud way. Is that what you meant?
Well, we didn't want to take and spin up a VM that we had on premise and reinstall all the technology that was on there because it was old.
So in that case, you decided not to? How did you solve that problem in Azure then?
So we were able to utilize, in this case, we're on-premise. We were a VMware shop with VMs, and we used Veeam for technology. And Veeam has a tool built in that allows you to migrate that on-premise VMware VM and port it over and create a Azure VM through their tool, which has worked flawlessly for us. So it's allowed us to take older VMs and port them over, dump over the VHD over into a storage account, tag it or associate it to a network infrastructure, and then take and continue to use that VM and get out of the on-premise the hardware.
So this is basically an easy way for you to migrate an existing VM without having to, you know, kind of snapshot the VHD yourself and copy the VHD. And I think, Sajid, our Azure Site Recovery product has similar capabilities, right, to kind of stream the information up to Azure, and then now you've got this VM or VHD up in Azure that you can go and run on. We see a lot of people do what Martin's done.
But correct me if I'm wrong, though. Don't we have some restrictions on how old the operating system can be?
Well,
at least from a support perspective, I know.
Yes.
If I'm getting some people into trouble here.
No. We actually, lots of things will run in Azure. We just don't officially support it. I don't know, Martin, I don't know how far you guys go back in terms of OS, whether, you know, you're talking all the way back to like 2003 or 2008 or what?
I'm forcing anything 2003? No. I think we've gone back as far. Usually they're a 2008 R2 machine or 2008 pre-R2.
Okay.
So I'm not going...
Not ancient, then.
It's not old, ancient. It's the level of effort it would take for our developer to turn around and install all of the components on that machine to get it back to a state where it can be used again, or if we can just port it over. And some of them are various versions of the same VM, but at different snapshot points. because we had different components on that machine, we needed to test again. Yeah. So we can go and port over 7 versions of a VM as 7 different VMs over into Azure. And then we're only turning one of those machines on at a time based off of what our need is to be able to go back and test against a particular build of a product that is, you know, from a compatibility standpoint.
Makes sense. Yeah, Sujeet, that's kind of what we see. I mean, 2003, I have heard that it will run. Whether it runs well is totally a different conversation. But definitely when you're talking 2008, 2008 R2, I mean, virtualization was really very common by that point in kind of the life cycle. So those run well. I mean, that's still a 10-year-old OS, but that's fully supported these days. 2008, you might see an early build. But 2008 might be what extended. Might be extended support these days. But yeah, those are generally okay.
Right.
Okay, go ahead, Martin. Yeah, so so that's one type of workload that you had on there. And you also mentioned the web applications. How do you, port those over?
And most of the web applications were spinning up new. That allows us to go over and kind of start fresh, start clean.
So you're using the app service for that, or just putting web apps in IaaS, in brand new IaaS instances?
We've used both the web app service, and we've also used a virtual machine where we have, in this case, the particular app required the use of Apache Tomcat on it,
right.
Back-end SQL, that type of, and it's usually a collaboration type of environment where it's going to be up for a short amount of time. But the kind of, if I step back to 18 months ago when this all kind of started, some of the things that we had to identify and resolve, I mentioned earlier, was authentication. It was first just being able to authenticate, understanding how that was going to function and get that wired up. Second was and fundamentally was tracking cost, needing to know on-premise, if you leave a bunch of machines on or if you have a bunch of services go and you have a static cost every month in a data center, you're not too worried about a machine being left on. Not the case, obviously, when you've ported over a bunch of machines or have a bunch of services, resources running, you want to know what's being used where, what's being tracked, what's costing you. So I started doing that through tags, muddled through a few months of trying to download the billing statement at the end and try to figure out what went where. And ultimately, and I think I might have talked to Evan about this earlier on, and that was beginning to establish subscriptions based off of different areas within the company. So I'm probably at almost, this might be absurd, but I'm probably at 25 subscriptions now, just depending on different cost centers, if you will, within the company.
So basically everybody kind of, you just give them the bill for their subscription then at that point, right. Just simplify your life.
Exactly, yeah. And then with that, because each one of those subscriptions exists, it's a matter of setting up networks within each one, and then a lot of setting up peering between those on need. Yeah, and you don't really know this until you start building it and then you start realizing the impact of what you're doing.
So why do you set up a network post-subscription?
It allows me to segment off. So if I'm if I have a subscription where I've got I'm collaborating with a client, or I've got a set of VMs that's particular for that client, I can track everything that's associated with that client or with that prospect or with that billing center, if you will.
Okay.
Yeah, we see that a lot, Sujeet, where it's just easier to from a you know, security boundary and everything, just say, hey, this set of VNets know nothing about the other ones, right? They're not even in the same sub. They're not even, you know, I mean, you can still do it and still be fairly secure even within, but some people just find it easier to just conceptually to manage it in that fashion.
So it sounds like you're almost doing like a multi-tenant system this way, right?
It's all in a single tenant, but it does have, by breaking it down by subscription, that's allowing me to segment this off. I can I can, in the future, invite different users or people within our company to have more administrative rights within that subscription, within those VMs, depending on how far we go. So it's kind of a long-term vision as much as a short-term solution to say, okay, I'm going to encapsulate everything related to this particular effort is going to be encapsulated. So if at the end of the year, I need to know how much did my VMs, networking, storage, anything, any of those resources that were related to, say, our TFS. So we've recently moved our on-premise TFS over to VMs running TFS. So I want to know everything that all the costs associated. I can see all that. And then now also say in the process we're migrating over to VSTS. So that will... much of what we're doing inside of our TFS is kind of, it will become legacy, and everything in the future will be over in the VSTS environment.
So it's interesting, Martin, you said that, you know, in an on-premises data center that you don't really care if the machine's on because you kind of know what your fixed cost is every month, right? It's a capital expense at that point. And in Azure, you now get the flexibility that when you turn this machine off, you're not paying for it versus on-premises, whether my machine's running or not, I'm still paying the lease on it, right? So it's actually better to keep it running because then somebody might use it. Are you finding, the statement that I've typically made to customers when I talk to them is, you know, if you were to run your machines 24/7, 365 in Azure versus the same machine on-premises, you're actually probably going to spend more money on a, you know, over the annualized cost, but where you save the money is doing what it sounds like you're doing, which is building up rules and logic that says, hey, on the weekend, shut off these servers. On the, at night, turn off this other set of servers, which on-premises you can do, but it's really difficult to kind of do at scale and manage because there's a lot of physical switching on and off of stuff.
Well, and you're not saving money, right, by doing it anyways.
Right. You're saving power, I guess.
You're still on, exactly. You're still on the machine.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. So you have your initial, if you own the CapEx expenditure of buying that hardware and appreciating over a period of however many years, or if you accelerate it into a year, and in a small company like us, when you multiply that times three host machines, the other stack of hardware in the rack, and then the networking, switching, and gear, and everything else you've got to have in place. You have a static cost of the lease of the rack or multiple racks, whatever you're in, and then any additional costs. You have that annual, okay, well, they're going to bump you up on your annual lease amount, right? So that's never coming down. So when you begin to look at that and then say, okay, well, all right, I've got a slice here called SharePoint. What would that look like if I were to port that over and put that on SharePoint.com? Okay, that's now one slice out of that rack. All right, and then you begin to dwindle that down and begin to look and say, like you said, is begin to automate the machines that come 10 o'clock tonight, Pacific time. Most of our machines will start shutting down and turning off. And I can tell you, kind of talk to you more about some of the things I've done there. But and then tomorrow morning, and it's only a few hours, because if you think about it, 10 p.m. Pacific and then maybe 6, 7 o'clock
But that adds up over the course of the
East Coast time. It certainly does. The other thing we do is some of those machines don't auto-start because they don't need to be auto-started. You know, we need them down.
Yeah.
I need them shut down by the end of the day, but I need my resources and my users. If they need them, they can go in there and turn them on. So I've done a lot with Azure Active Directory groups to be able to say, okay, you're a member, you're a contributor to this VM using Azure's their group
partner.
Exactly. Yeah. And I can go in and say, all right, you can turn this on. You can see when it's on based off of the groups you're a part of. And then taking that same Azure AD group and embedding it inside the VM and saying, okay, you also have rights to log in that machine and perform actions inside the machine itself.
Gotcha.
So a lot of visibility to my users to be able to turn things on when they need them, turn things off when they don't, and then automate if they forget. Automate the shutdown at the end of the day so it doesn't sit there and run all night.
Did you find, so, you know, and we're all fundamentally lazy, right? And we want to kind of do our stuff at last minute. Did you find that you had to kind of, I don't know, sell them on or maybe educate your end users on, yes, I understand it's going to take an extra 5 minutes for this machine to boot up, but look at the benefit to us as an organization? Or did you find that they generally just kind of got it right away and really didn't complain about it?
So prior to beginning this migration on-premise, I started running PowerShell scripts to shut down machines, groups of machines every night. So began to implement that that process already on-premise.
So they were used to that from your user base.
Kind of used to it, a little bit of pushback sometimes, but one of the things I've done to help them, and that is when the machine comes on, once they go in, they hit start, and then there's that uncertainty of, well, what's it doing? It says it's updating. All right, well, how long is this going to be? One of the last things it does is it sends out an email to a group, to distribution group, and if they want to be a part of that group membership, they can, and then they'll see when that machine comes online, because it'll send an email out and post an entry that says machine's turned on. So that kind of gives them some visibility. And the other thing I did also on the shutdown side of it is with the Azure Labs, it's built in now where you can say shut down automatically X time. One of the things that's built into it now is this webhook. Tying that webhook over into Slack, which allows them to join that Slack and say, okay, I'm going to get a notification, like my phone will bing from time to time when something's automated. Well, it'll give you a notice there, and you can say, well, skip this or delay this an hour. And that's built into that function, which is pretty slick.
Martin, just a quick question about, you know, when you were migrating this stuff over, at some point you may have had some stuff in Azure and some stuff on-premise, right?
Sure.
Because obviously it's took 18 months and you're kind of still working through it. How did you kind of handle that hybrid scenario, you know, where you had some stuff in each area?
So right now, I'm probably, over the last 2 months, has been that hybrid period. So I'm in the final 30 to 45 days here. I still have some on-premise. I know that the bulk of the machines still left are domain controllers and file servers and things that I can't shut down until we're fully out. Most of the users have already have seen their machines migrated over. So one of the things I've done through the process was track this. Much of this, as you can imagine, I had on-premise, I had 234 VMs on-premise, 230 plus VMs. So if you think about the volume of those machines trying to notify users, notify who the members of, who owns and uses that machine, and then letting them know that, okay, this machine is now over on Azure. Here's where it used to be. Here's where it is now. Here's how you used to log into it. Here's how you log into it now. That's been key, the keeping users informed, getting the owner of the VM to sign off when it's okay now in the new environment. That allows me then to they've gone through and said, yes, I can log on what's now on Azure, and now they have to check a box that says, okay, it's clear to delete the on-premise one. And I had one or two times where people said, oh, did you actually delete it? I'm like, you said yes, it's okay to delete it. So I've gone and actually deleted it. It's gone. So,
but how about the networking issues? Did you have to set up a VPN or something between the two environments to share information?
The only connection between the two environments is Azure Connect, AD Connect.
Right.
Otherwise, they're two separate environments. We do authenticate in Azure with our Azure credentials, which are already synchronizing right now with on-premise, we'll be turning that that corner, and I haven't figured this one out yet, but that is to break my connection to on-premise and have the Federation up in Azure. So we'll be getting there over the next few weeks.
That's very good.
That's neat. So you said, you know, 45 to 60 days, or 30 to 45 days, and you think you're done. You know, it'd be great to, you know, send me an email at the end and say, hey, we're done. We're off and we're out. And at that point, you guys will actually just turn off everything that's in the data center, right? You're totally done.
We will shut down. I've already sent the termination notice to the data center.
Wow.
So they know.
Give yourself a deadline now.
Yes. I have a countdown clock that runs up on SharePoint.com, our internal SharePoint site, which is my countdown clock that tells me how much time I have left. But, so that termination is in place. We will physically move everything out and will be done in the ownership of hardware and ownership of technology in that way. So,
wow.
Okay.
That's amazing.
That's great. This is, I like the way that you've kind of organized this. Very nicely done, Martin. I think it's some good information for our subscribers there to also follow these kind of steps, right? Because we don't think about all the other things, like you said, you know, the whole billing aspect, the tagging, you know, how you organize stuff. Those are important things as well. I think we've never spoken about those things before. I'm glad you brought them up.
Sure. Yeah. So some of the things that I have that's been key to help me do my job well, and that is keeping a log, keeping a tracking log, where things are, what the state of things are. If you think about that much technology and the resources that you're trying to decide on where it needs to go, where its new home's going to be, we have a SharePoint list that keeps track of all of our virtual machines so we know what's where. Keeping that all updated. Much of this is all about communication to the users. Keeping them informed keeps them happy. And ultimately, the end, my job is to make it seem like to them they went to one place one day and they got a new link and they got to the new link the next day, but it all is the same to them. And that's the key to success for me, to make sure that happens and happens smoothly for them. Behind the scenes, you know, there's all kinds of stuff that has to go on to create storage accounts and peer networks and, you know, deal with all kinds of things. So,
yep.
So a couple of futures. So we're going to move towards B2B because part of our effort is to include and incorporate some of our clients to be able to authenticate, or prospects to be able to authenticate and go, you know, continue to use that try before buy type of solution. And then also implementing B2C with some of our prospects on a web app that we're developing. So that'll be fun to kind of really focus more on futures in the coming months. So,
I mean, you know, I'm glad to see you're really embracing all the stuff that Azure has to offer, right? Azure has all these services, which we're still trying to cover in our podcast, by the way.
We will never catch up over
3 years, and we're still working on it.
Sure.
But I'm glad to see that you're taking good advantage of those, and that's just the right approach, I think. So, well, Martin, I think this has been a great. Great discussion. Again, thank you for your time. Evan, anything else for Martin before we wrap up here?
No, this is great. It's so much better, Martin, talking to you about how things are working successfully instead of when things are broken.
You guys have been great. I've called upon you quite a bit, and it's been great, and I encourage others to do the same. You can find a lot of information out there on the various sites, but in the end, opening the case and getting fantastic support has been key.
Cool. Great to hear it. Awesome.
That's very great. All right, Martin. Good talking to you.
Thanks, Martin.
Thanks, guys. Have a good day.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.